Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Miguel Delaney of The Independent, and Glenn Moore of World Soccer. It's easy, and usually justifiable, to mock football's marketing machine. But whoever came up with the line about the Premier League being the best league in the world has at least some grasp of reality. All four Premier League clubs have qualified for the last 16 of the Champions League. They're all likely to end up as group winners. Chelsea need to match the result of Juventus in this week's final round of group games to join the top-seeded teams in the knockout draw. I suppose the question is, Glenn, are they capable of retaining the title?
Well, you have to say they are, obviously. I mean, they're a stronger team than they were last year with the addition of Lukaku. You say the full-back, I mean, obviously Chilwell's injured at the moment, but I mean, James has come on even in the last year from where he was. So I'd say they look a stronger side. And Tuchel's had a full season, well, full pre-season with them. The question is, of course, sometimes it's hard. Obviously, you're usually harder to retain something than it is to win the first time. And, you know, as the champions, they're there to be shot at. And of course, this year, I guess they're more entrenched and involved in the domestic front in terms of trying to win the Premier League. But yeah, they've certainly got a chance. And the biggest threat is quite likely to come from another Premier League club. Because, I mean, in football, as in life, money equals power. And the Premier League has the greatest depth of cash and therefore has the most powerful clubs, except with the obvious exceptions of one or two individual clubs from elsewhere in the continent.
When you look at Chelsea, Migs, it was a statement victory over Juventus, wasn't it, after having lost to them earlier on in the group. What did that say about Chelsea, but also what did it say about Juventus and, by extension, the quality of Serie A at the moment?
Yeah, it was a real display of power as well as a display of the gap in quality and gap really in financial power as well between the best in England or England generally, and Italy. I mean, Serie A is going through, I suppose, an interesting situation right now because Juventus have been the power for so long, 9 titles in a row, that run finally broken by Inter, which is overall healthier for the competition. But and I think Juventus are a very specific... There's something very, very specific consequences from this kind of post-COVID era. Basically, all changed the dynamic of the game where they're a club with a load of pre-COVID contracts that can't move any of those players on and it because of the contracts they're on. And it's created the situation where even though they actually have made some moves to try and bring the squad into the next era, you know, there are some really good young players at Juventus with Chiesa among the most prominent. They've still just got a core of players from before that ultimately mean it's difficult to move on to a completely new approach as well. Now, there's also an irony there in the fact that having got rid of Ronaldo and I suppose you would say hastening the move to a new era, this also marks a point where suddenly after 2 years of trying, you know, these coaches perceived as progressive or modern who Ronaldo wouldn't necessarily fit, well, they've gone back to a kind of an arch pragmatist in Allegri. And suddenly, after so long, where they'd got to the top of Italian football through having such a clearly defined identity, suddenly they're struggling for one again. And it does mean, even though it's been such a good Serie A race this season, you only have to look at the European positions to show that Italy's top quality is some way off the top of the game. But then that's not a unique situation, because it's the way the direction European football is going, where so much of the money, in fact, I would say a concerning amount when you look at the last broadcasting deal, is going towards the Premier League. And as you say, the best league in the world has almost become a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. That's how it's been marketed. The marketing has been worked, or has worked well, and it's just, it's created this virtuous cycle for the Premier League, if a concerning one for the rest of the game, where more and more money goes into England at the expense of everything else. And it means, I think, so like the question you asked at the top, it's almost not about whether Chelsea can win the Champions League. It's really how many competitors are actually going to have that might take their trophy outside of England.
Well, when you look at Manchester City, Glenn, you know, we expect them to complete the formalities in Leipzig on Tuesday. Inevitably, everything will revolve around Pep Guardiola, given his past indiscretions and temptations, or succumbing to the temptations to tinker. There was an interesting line that he came up with, saying, "I'm not going to train another English club." What did you draw from that? Is that the first sign that maybe his club career is starting to draw to a close?
Possibly. I mean, look, he had 4 years at Barcelona, didn't he, when he started? Then he had a year off. He went to New York and relaxed. Then 3 years at Bayern, no break, straight to City. He said 5 years this summer. Contract will take him to 7 years, I guess. 51 next month. But I mean, so when the contract's done, he's going to be what? He's still going to be early 50s. Possibly, it depends what options come up. I mean, yeah, okay, so if he isn't going to go back to, you know, or look at the places where he's been, the only really option, if he's not going to go back to Spain, I mean, I suppose he could go back to Barcelona at some point. I certainly wouldn't rule that out if they're on a better footing than they are at the moment. Doesn't do anyone else in England, probably doesn't go back to Germany. As we've just been discussing, you can't see any great attraction going to Italy at the moment, though, you know, again, who knows where we'll be in 5 years down the line. PSG, I suppose, is always going to be on the horizon. They're always going to be linked with the top coaches. But he's still a young man. Where will be the next temptation? International football. I mean, I think we're pretty clear that given the intensity he puts into it, he'd have done 10 years of management without a break when his contract at City's over. And I suspect he will then look to take a year or two out. But, yeah, then he's going to be mid-50s, potentially still another decade at least involved in football. You can't see someone like that just wanting to sort of sit on those UEFA and FIFA committees and watch matches and write reports and occasionally do some consultancy roles. So it's every back, I guess, a problem. You sort of start cutting off one or two avenues, don't you, after a while. We'll see. Never say never, as they say.
When you talk about his intensity, how would you describe his handling at the moment of Jack Grealish? You know, he's characteristically put pressure on him in the last couple of weeks by stressing that, look, he doesn't want to wait until next season for him to justify himself.
Yeah, there was a little bit of a shift in tone, actually, I suppose, just before the Villa game. And maybe that's because he knew it was going to be, shall we say, a delicate evening for Grealish, where he suddenly kind of, you know, he literally said that Grealish's performances have been better than maybe the player himself perceives. But it is almost a kind of that classic adaptation period of Guardiola, isn't it? I mean, this is basically why his teams are so good when they reach top level, because the system is actually quite difficult to learn. You know, it's been said by so many players in the past, but it's essentially like learning football anew, and almost you've got to forget everything you know and build up a new mental architecture of the game. And that is the way modern football is going, and it's why coaches like Tuchel and Guardiola and Klopp, they are, you know, form this elite band, and why you're left behind if you don't have anything to kind of buy into these principles, as we've seen with Manchester United. And it will just make it, for a lot of players, it's down to their, I suppose, their tactical awareness, their tactical appreciation, and how willing they are to adapt. But I think Grealish, to be fair, has shown that willingness. I think for everyone that knows him would also call him, you know, he's one of those players that does breathe the game in that way and is willing to learn. So I wouldn't really have any concerns there. Although maybe he could perhaps, that's what I mean, City are already true, but maybe that's one way the remaining Champions League game could be of value in that we could see maybe another night where Grealish steps up a little bit in the competition.
Liverpool end in the San Siro against Milan. We know the potential complicating factors at a domestic level. They're likely to be compromised by call-ups to the African Cup of Nations, Glenn. Does that mean that they potentially got a better chance of winning the Champions League than the Premier League? Because obviously, we don't resume after this week's round until mid-Feb.
Yeah, I mean, I guess from a Liverpool point of view, it's hanging in there during that period in sort of January, early February, when the Mane, Salah and Naby Keita go off to AFCON. But what they have got, they've got maybe less so up front, but they've got some really talented young players at the club. So you imagine they're quite well covered in some ways. There's no real cover for Mane and Salah, though. I mean, obviously, if Firmino's fit, you've got Jota, then you've got two players there. But I imagine it may be a case, see where they are in early February, and then if they're still up with the top two and they've got those players coming back, if they're still up there with Chelsea and City and they've got those players coming back, then very much the Premier League is a possibility. If not, then maybe it is a case of prioritising the Champions League, and because it is a long season with lots of matches, and I certainly expect them to rotate in this game this week and maybe see some of those young players. But it'd be a holding case trying to get through those matches when those players are away.
Yeah, we've spoken about the mistakes perhaps enshrined by the whole system of the Ballon d'Or voting, which basically almost enshrines celebrity over achievement. Mo Salah, I know it's an old question, but I think it's worth revisiting, Megs. On current form, and when you look at someone like Lionel Messi going through the motions at PSG in many games, he's the best player in the world, isn't he?
Yeah, I think so. And the way, I mean, when I kind of think about this question, I almost like it's almost a case that I play a little game with myself where basically, if you're a defender or you're an opposition team and you imagine what player you'd least like getting the ball on any given moment because of the damage they can do to you and how much they can hurt you, I would say right now it's Salah. I mean, obviously Messi's ceiling as a player is higher, but now it's a question of how often he gets to that level. And I was at the Paris Saint-Germain Man City game last week. I was actually at both of the games. And while the first one was, of course, decorated by Messi's brilliant goal, which seemed his announcement moment to Paris Saint-Germain, he hasn't really completely kicked on since then, to the point where the performance in Manchester last week, I was actually quite shocked by it. Myself and my colleague Mark Critchley, just towards the end of the game, there was a point where we were, when Paris Saint-Germain should have been chasing the match, we were kind of watching Messi. And he was literally just standing there for about 4 minutes. Now, I know it's always been a feature of his game where he waits, he conserves his energy, and then when he needs to get involved, he bursts. But equally, I've seen him in situations where when Barcelona weren't on it, he would immediately get involved and try and lift them back into the game. Whereas it was a much more passive Messi. And against that, you've got, as you say, it's the sonic blur of Salah right now. And just how many dimensions there are to his game, how he moves, what he can do to you when he's on the ball. And the one caveat I would say is actually, I don't think he warranted the Ballon d'Or this year. And in fact, I can actually see the rationale of Messi winning it, even though I wouldn't necessarily have voted for him if I had a vote. Because, he was instrumental in winning a major trophy. And I do think, given its international award, it should go beyond the domestic. And Salah ultimately, last season, was what they went out in the Champions League in the quarterfinal. Now, I probably would have given it to Kante, actually, I must say, because the unprecedented situation of so many Man of the Match performances in a row in a victorious Champions League campaign. But yeah, in terms of what someone can do to you on a pitch at any given moment, the most dangerous player in the world right now, I think, is Mohamed Salah.
Yeah, he certainly deserved better than to finish seventh. I know that for a fact. When you look at teams outside England, Glenn, let's focus on a couple of them. And let's continue to focus on PSG. Is there a case to be made that front three is almost unmanageable because it's almost like a force commercially and in a sporting sense, of its own making?
Well, it does. You do get the feeling watching them that there's a lack of commitment and desire amongst them as a unit. I mean, it doesn't really work for the way Pochettino likes his teams to play, obviously. But I mean, it's surprising in a way. You might have thought that, I guess, I might have hoped that, that having the three of them together would have sparked a competitive edge between them, or to try, you know, be the best, be the leading light in that front three. But it hasn't really worked out like that. I mean, there have been moments when they've connected and balanced off each other, but you know, it looks like Messi's there because basically there was nowhere else to go, and Mbappe's there because they wouldn't let him leave, and Neymar's been slightly put out that he's no longer the main man. So all three of them look as if they slightly resent being there, rather than, you know, looking and think, okay, what can we create? What can we do here? It's a tough thing for a manager to pull together to get those players to really want to focus, yeah, and work together for the benefit of the team rather than regard themselves as individuals. You know, you look at the rest of the side of it, it does seem, you know, hugely unbalanced in various areas, and the City game was quite revealing in terms of how dominant City were. When you've got those players, it's like a heavyweight, you know, with a good punch. You've always got a chance when you've got players like that on the pitch. Yeah, and the margins at this level aren't that, you know, are pretty tight, particularly when you get into you know, two-legged matches. So you get, you know, they've got obviously good keeper, two good keepers. So you've always got a puncher's chance when you've got players like that. But you'd have to say you can't really see them coming through all those knockout rounds and win the competition.
If you're looking at the most likely contenders from mainland Europe, Migs, is there any point looking beyond Bayern Munich?
No, I don't think so. I think they're the only club at the moment that comes close to the main Premier League three, and also have a proper ideology there. The one thing I agree with Glenn about Paris Saint-Germain, but the one thing I would say is that once it gets into the knockout stages and it becomes a cup, this is something that has been eroding over the years as football becomes increasingly ideological, but there is still, it can still happen that in the kind of the nature of knockout competition, that a solid base and extreme individual quality, and PSG really have that, can still get you going far. You don't even have to play that well. In fact, Real Madrid are probably the proof of that over the 2014 and 2018 period, even though I think they did have a more cohesive system than this Paris Saint-Germain. Especially, and I get, that's always going to happen when you've basically got Modric and Kroos imposing a system on a team. But yeah, I do think it's really Bayern Munich, and I find that quite a sad situation. The Champions League, it should be about a breadth of contenders right across the continent, not concentration of quality and power in certain areas, certain pockets. And it was already a problem where, you know, a band of super clubs where all but two of them ended up getting involved in these plans for a Super League back in April. But it feels like that problem has gone into another level where there's an extra band of super clubs who are, you know, the Premier League core, and maybe one or two who can keep pace at any given time. Thankfully, one is Bayern Munich. But imagine Bayern Munich were going through one of their own periodic crisis points, as they had in 2019 before their return. And what would it look like then? And I actually, I have wondered in the past few weeks whether one of the kind of unintended consequences of all this, or a response to Premier League power, whether there's almost some in other countries that see some sort of Super League among themselves as a necessity to counterbalance England's extreme influence.
You could see that happening. I mean, the interesting thing is, though, I mean, you could argue that with this increasing English dominance of the competition, it might become less watchable. But it's actually been, I mean, I've enjoyed a lot of the stuff this year on BT. And there's been one or two groups that have had a bit of jeopardy about them. Been some interest, been some, you know, some excellent football played in by one or some of the teams. There have been some quite good games, and some one or two teams that you wouldn't expect to be struggling, you know, in the group stages, to be struggling in the group stage. I mean, Barcelona being an obvious point, Dortmund. You know, and there's one or two groups that are quite evenly poised in terms of who's going through. So there has been some quite interesting stuff. I mean, the Liverpool group is fascinating behind Liverpool. I mean, they're obviously running away with it. But so, I don't really say it's that leveling up mediocrity below the English teams, or just a certain balance, but it has become, so the group stage has been a more interesting group stage, I think, than it has been for some years in that respect.
Let's look at you know, Bayern. Well, when I think of Bayern at the moment, I think of Robert Lewandowski. So many goals since the start of the 1920 season, around 130, which is just a ridiculous figure. Mix, do you think he's a sort of an Ibrahimovic type of player in terms of, you know, durability, perhaps, rather than personality, who can play until probably he's 40?
Yeah, I'd say so. And you only have to look at his physique now. To be honest, I've actually always thought of him a level above Ibrahimovic. And he's also got the Champions League that Ibrahimovic doesn't. And also, I mean, in terms of going to 40, it does probably help that now so much of his career, set over 7 years of it, has been in what is a fairly forgiving domestic situation, where, you know, Bayern are obviously in such a position of financial power there themselves. And like, if you talk to people around Erling Haaland, where even though I suppose Mineirola is making almost every super club think they have a chance with him, but one of the reasons why it's said he would prefer to either stay in Germany or go to Spain before an eventual move to England later in his career is because of the intensity of the English schedule. Because ultimately, when you're in a more forgiving competition in terms of the power of your club, it's less sapping, basically. And this is something that Lewandowski has benefited from. Now, of course, he's pushed himself to the limit, but it can't be overlooked that Bayern's dominance gives him that platform as well. But yeah, I think we could well be talking about someone that goes into the late 30s in that way.
Barcelona must take a point from Bayern in Munich to progress. Glenn, what about the Xavi factor?
I was just thinking that if Lewandowski plays into a 40, he might finally win the Ballon d'Or one year. Everyone else would have retired. It's made a bit of a change at Barcelona. I think just as important is what they end up playing in Bayern. I mean, COVID's meant the ground looks like it's going to be closed into all fans. They've got, obviously, COVID in the camp. They've had this issue around Kimmich. Yeah, they've got quite a lot of players missing training and being isolated. So, and, of course, they're basically through. So it might not be quite as daunting a prospect as it would have appeared earlier on in the season in that respect. And Barca do look like, obviously, Xavi's got in there and... Yeah, he's obviously turned around the support and much more behind him. So you say they've got a reasonable chance of coming through. It's going to be a very odd Champions League in the last 16 if Barcelona aren't in it, I must admit.
Yeah. If you look at the broader situation, which is what we're trying to do here, I suppose, are we now in a situation where the reverence for the top two in Spain, Migs, is almost outdated?
Yes, I would say so. Now, I mean, what's happened in Spanish football is quite interesting. I mean, there are at least some parallels with what's happened in Italy, although I think Madrid have certainly navigated the situation better than Barcelona have. They got ahead of it, and they're probably helped by their own huge megastar who has such a gravitational pull on any club he's at, and also will occupy so much of the wage bill moving on 3 years earlier, in that it allowed an earlier rebuilding from Real Madrid. But, I mean, ultimately, the Spanish league was, for pretty much for a fairly long time, almost hollowed out due to the power of the big two. That did become kind of a big 2.5 almost because of Atletico Madrid there, and they are the champions right now. And they went from being too big to fail to almost so big they had to fail. And we are, it feels like we're in that kind of post-Classico era. Now, the one pity is, I would say, is that, like in Italy, this time should be rife for, finally some alternative champions to come in, just to kind of increase the competitive vitality of Spanish football. But instead, we have Madrid back on top, back in power. But it's not the Madrid of a few years ago. It's a much more diluted team. They just look, they look so lacking in both style and stars compared to the English clubs, really. Now, given it's Real Madrid, given there is still that kind of almost muscle memory, they're going to be dangerous in any knockout, but I wouldn't have them close to that top band of contenders, to be honest.
Yeah, Real Madrid must take a point from the final group game against Inter at the Bernabeu to top their group. You're a bit like me, Glenn. Do you find something quite reassuring in a strange sort of nostalgic way that you see Carlo Ancelotti and his eyebrows out there on the touchline?
Well, and he's, you know, did a pretty good job, hasn't he? I mean, you know, they're, what looked like would have been, as Mick says, an interesting title race in Spain. Suddenly, you know, they've started stringing together a whole series of wins. They're putting clear. They're playing quite decent football. Benzema's obviously having a good spell with them. Really sort of flourished since Ronaldo's moved on. Yeah, it's... Yeah, I mean, Everton must look wistfully at what they had. Yeah, he's been a very good manager of those sort of high-powered, high-profile teams with those superstars in it for a long time, and seems to have the knack of getting them to play for and blending together a whole series of, you know, powerful personalities within the unit. Yeah, and one of the old guard who's still hanging on.
Yeah, when we're looking at dangerous floaters in the knockout phase of the competition, Migs, I suppose we have to include Manchester United in that, don't we?
Yeah, and it's almost from the same perspective as Paris Saint-Germain. Even had they not employed, you know, one of these ideology coaches in Rangnick, there's just that inherent danger is that when you're wealthy enough to have some stars, individual quality can still go a long way in knockout games. Not to the same degree as it used to. I think the Champions League is a slightly different era now, and especially given just how influential having a defined ideology is. But there is still that danger there. And we'll see the Rangnick effect. It could be one of those situations where, I mean, I do think it is a positive that Manchester United have appointed Rangnick, although it is such an abrupt change in approach that there are no guarantees he can have a quick effect. But could we well see one of those situations where almost they're still adapting in the Premier League, but just the kind of air of a Champions League brings out something more in them. And also seems kind of Rangnick exact his quality a bit more. Let's not forget, actually, beyond building two clubs at Hoffenheim and RB Leipzig, his probably greatest success in the game is his run to the Champions League semi-finals in 2011 with Schalke, that did end at Old Trafford with Manchester United beating them. And while I wouldn't have them in that top band of challengers just because of the nature of their season, again, like Paris Saint-Germain, there's that danger there. I probably have them actually a little bit below Paris Saint-Germain as well. But, I mean, this again comes back to what we're talking to. For me, it almost feels like you'd have the top three favourites, or top four favourites already, yeah. Those English three that are currently top of the Premier League right now, Bayern Munich, Paris Saint-Germain, then a level below that, and Manchester United level below that, and then another kind of band of contenders.
If Man United are going to win it, I think David De Gea will probably be a shout for the Ballon d'Or, because he's going to do an awful lot of brilliant goalkeeping if they're going to win it, because defensively they're not very good.
Mm. What would you, if you're Rangnick, Glenn, what would your priorities be with United?
Probably the priorities of most new managers come into a club with mixed results, stop conceding goals to start with, sort out the back four, become hard to beat. And that's easy in a way, United, because you've got those players on the pitch who will score goals out of very little. So you've got a reasonable shout that you're going to score some goals, even if you're focusing on the defence primarily in your first bit. Yeah, if you get Maguire fit and back in confidence, that would be a big bonus, clearly. You've got to sort of, you know, a bit of the full-backs. There's quite a lot to do in the back four. And then the screening, getting that midfield balance is quite tricky. So there is quite a lot to do to basically become harder to beat, is I would say, is the main thing. I mean, games like the Watford game shouldn't be happening to a team with as many good players as United have got. You can rely on the fact that you're going to get the odd goal poached at the other end simply by because you've got such good players. So I would say that's the main thing. But the interesting thing about the Rangnick appointment and the fact that they've said we will be getting another manager in is, what do they do in January in terms of buying? Who's making the decisions? Who are you buying for? Do you buy anybody in January? Because it's a notoriously difficult time to buy players anyway. Or do you just try and work with what you've got and to the end of the season and see where you are and then see who the new manager is coming in and then invest big time in the summer?
Mm. Well, they're likely to exact revenge against Young Boys at Old Trafford on Wednesday. Migs, if I was a Hollywood scriptwriter sitting on my well upholstered behind in 80 degrees, I'd probably come up with a scenario where it's going to be, the Champions League is going to be the last hurrah for Cristiano Ronaldo. Am I being a little bit optimistic?
Again, I wouldn't rule it out the way these things go. And maybe along the way, I mean, one of the things that I thought basically after, especially after going to the City Paris Saint-Germain game last week, along the way, United taking on Pochettino's Paris Saint-Germain in one of the knockout games, potentially the last 16, just to flavour it that bit more. But let's not get ahead of ourselves either. If it is to happen, United need a lot to go their way. And also we're going to have this question of how Rangnick adapts to Ronaldo and how he uses him in Europe. And I suppose as well, actually, how Ronaldo adapts to Rangnick, because it's not just kind of a cliche or an easy thing something to say. There is quite an obvious potential tension there, given it's a manager who favours high pressing from all angles. You know, as I think the famous, the line has done the rounds a lot now, basically. I think it might be from the coach's voice. I mean, apologies if the credit isn't correct. You don't just press a little bit. You're either, you know, it's like being pregnant. You either press or you don't press. And this is one of the issues that Ronaldo throws up, because, you know, everyone's seen the stats this season. And while it actually maybe shouldn't have been, it shouldn't necessarily have been as big an issue as it was under Solskjaer, because Solskjaer teams didn't press. Rangnick teams very much do. So it's going to be interesting to see how that's squared. But yeah, at the very least, though, the fact they're through, which, you know, didn't look or wouldn't have looked that certain without Ronaldo. I mean, ultimately, they are through because of his goals, and that still allows for the greater debate over whether United would be in the same situation had they not signed Ronaldo. But he's forced them into the last 16, and there's at least a little bit of momentum there.
If you're the scriptwriter, you're going to beat Real Madrid in the final. You're going to take out probably Barcelona, City and Liverpool on the way, or maybe Juve. Yeah, it's quite a tall order, though.
You're not kidding. If you look at the other sides around Ajax, they are 100% going into the final group game against Sporting Lisbon. Erik ten Hag, you know, he's in the conversation for Manchester United's next manager rather than next interim manager. That a viable candidate, you think, Glenn?
Well, yes. I think there is an issue sometimes, you know, can managers from those smaller leagues, you know, thrive in the bigger leagues? It's quite hard to judge the Dutch league, because there's only two or three decent teams normally. Quite a lot of players have come out of there and not flourished, and same with coaches. Then again, others have. There is the issue that those big sort of super clubs increasingly looking for people with experience of running super clubs. So you're looking at a relatively small group, or people with a sort of fixed, you know, body of work behind them. I would say it'd be an interesting choice. Certainly not a wild one. And there aren't that many candidates out there that you would imagine. When you're sifting through the possibilities for United, and then you're ruling out all the people who you probably won't get or can't get, and then which clubs very rarely seem to do, you know, decide on a type and then go for a manager of that type, or to just start working their way through a list of names, you know, who often don't seem to bear any kind of relationship to each other. You would have to say the way United have been running recent years doesn't fill you with an awful lot of confidence as to what they're going to end up with.
What about, you know, the Ajax model, Migs? Their teams tend to have a short window of opportunity because the best players are routinely sold. Is this a model worth cherishing in the modern world?
I wouldn't say it's worth cherishing, actually, because unfortunately it's proven itself as the best possible or the optimum solution for clubs outside the elite to fight this kind of what is ultimately kind of a crippling financial disparity in football. I mean, and like we shouldn't overlook this, but just the basic sadness that a club of Ajax's size and potential and history is now reduced to working around this in the game, and, you know, and trying to force a way through. But that is the reality of modern football. It's become one that basically everyone outside of the elite has to emulate. Dortmund have succeeded with it to varying degrees. Leicester were the closest example in England, and Sevilla in Spain. But Ajax have probably actually had it work to the greatest effect in Europe, given what it was, a Europa League run to the final in 2017, a Champions League run to the semi-finals in 2019. And given their performances this season, I don't think we can rule anything out bar the likelihood that come the end of the season, their best players and probably their manager will once again be picked off.
Mm. What about other outstanding issues, Glenn? I suppose the most intriguing one is who finishes second to Liverpool, which we mentioned earlier. I think I've got this right. So Atletico are in Porto, who hold a slight advantage by having 5 points to the others four. Milan must beat Liverpool and hope that other game is a draw, or Atletico win by the same margin or smaller, something like that. Yeah, very complicated build-up, but simple question. Who finishes second?
One for the goal show, isn't it? See them all going in when that's on. Well, Liverpool won five, played five, but I'd imagine he will be resting quite a lot of players in a away game heading into the busy December period. So Milan have got a reasonable chance of winning that. And if they do win that, then if the other game's not as decisive, they've got a reasonable chance. How big's that fence I'm looking for? I'm going to go for Milan on the grounds that the other game be a draw and they might win. But having said that, Liverpool don't lose very often at the moment.
This is true. The other area of intrigue at the moment will be Group G, Migs. All four teams there, Lille, Salzburg, Sevilla and Wolfsburg, can still go through. You know, they're all clubs. They're almost, I suppose, third, fourth tier European clubs. They're all punching at about their weight, aren't they?
Yeah, it points to something interesting about the Champions League, isn't it? Where the one group without a super club is actually the most interesting group, but conversely won't really attract the interest because it doesn't have any of the biggest names. Again, I know I suppose keep coming back to this theme in today's podcast, but it is a kind of dominant theme in European football now. But yeah, it is, competitively at least, it is the most fascinating group. Because even, I suppose, the big draw going into this week is going to be Bayern Munich-Barcelona. But the very fact Bayern Munich are in such a position of strength and they've already qualified means that there is at least a possibility that game isn't as enticing as it should be. And Barcelona just go out and get the result they need. And we can't rely, I suppose, Benfica slipping up either. But whereas I think a lot of the real intrigue and the real excitement, and where we could have one of those classic nights where you're looking, you're switching between the two stadiums, it comes in Group G. Although there is some possibility, I suppose, behind Liverpool as well.
It's a group that escaped the Europa League, I think someone said when it first was drawn. It does look like a good Europa League group.
Speaking of Europa League, Glenn, Leicester lead their Europa League group. They're a point clear of Spartak, who are in Warsaw on Thursday, and Napoli. Are Leicester capable of closing the deal by winning in Naples, do you think?
Well, they've come good more recently in the competition, haven't they? Their bids have settled down a bit more. They're getting one or two players back. I mean, they're still missing a couple of important defenders, so not quite there yet. But they have shown signs of recovering themselves recently. And we said that that's a difficult place to go, but a point to do the trick, wouldn't it? I'd have thought. So, I thought they should be able to pick up a point there.
What do you make of Leicester at the moment, Megs? They're almost, if you looked at them really harshly, they're almost the disappointment of the sort of top six at the moment, or top eight, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, but I do wonder whether it's just one of those classic situations where, this really shouldn't be overlooked. They've overachieved for so long. And because, I mean, in both of those, well, missing out in the Champions League was painted as a disappointment in both those seasons. The reality is they shouldn't have been that close just because of the way English football is. And had the seasons been reversed in the sense they started badly and finished well, I think it'd be a very different perspective of both. I think what's happened this season is almost, again, it's a combination of factors where there's got to have just been maybe a natural drop-off. Obviously, there's been interest in Brendan Rodgers as well. Just create a little bit more uncertainty. And, of course, injuries have been such a big issue, I think, particularly to Fofana. I think there have been signs they're finding their groove again lately. And although I do think, actually, performances have been broadly quite good even throughout this slump. And I wouldn't really have any deeper concerns. I do think they'll right themselves at the end of the season. And who knows, actually, we might well have that reverse of recent seasons where this is the one where they start badly and finish well and everyone again ends up talking about the upsurge of Leicester.
Mm. In the conference, the other competition, Spurs are at home to Rennes. Is this a case that Antonio Conte will look around. Let's imagine he's in an aeroplane which is beginning to stutter and the engine's beginning to cut out. Is he going to just basically hit the ejector button and get out of this competition, which they don't really need, although they should win it comfortably?
Well, it's interesting for such a malign competition. It's provided an awful lot of entertainment for neutrals with the travels of Spurs and, of course, Mourinho with Roma that they have gone through. Yeah, it is a competition you could do without. Having said that, it's quite embarrassing not going through. And where they're going to end up, they're going to end up playing quite a decent team coming down, should they do go through, because they can't come first in the group. It's going to cross his mind, but I think you want to win games, really, and particularly if you're stuttering a bit. And it's interesting what sort of side he puts out. I mean, I'd imagine it will be a mixed side rather than his first choice team with the fixtures coming up. And there will be plenty of motivation for those individual players who are very much underperformed when given opportunities in the conference so far to actually go out and show they are worth considering. Because let's suppose if it doesn't work out, they're not going to get many other games, those players, because he's not going to risk them in the Premier League. So, yeah, it depends on the draw in the FA Cup, I suppose. But this is not quite the last chance saloon for some of the players who've been playing, but it's getting quite close to it.
Mm. Conte isn't averse to blowing things up, is he, Miggs?
No. In fact, it's interesting how quickly he's gone to just talking about Spurs' general situation. Although, to be fair, that's exactly what he did at Chelsea. I was at that press conference where he started. I think he used the words Mourinho season, and that Chelsea were in danger of kind of another, which is, you know, one of the great drive-bys. I think one thing that should be overlooked with Conte, this isn't always a message to his own club to spend in the way that's perceived. It's also a message to his players, and it's attempting to jolt them. And this is what he's trying to do with Spurs, really, as well. He is trying to raise standards significantly, and particularly tell the players that this is what they'll get up to. Now, I suppose this game comes as kind of a curious situation for them, given that obviously the priority is the Premier League and they keep kind of wavering in terms of performances. But there is a chance of a trophy in the Europa Conference. And the problem, I mean, as we saw with the defeat last week, yeah, it can start to, even if it's a competition you'd willingly dispense with, it can still colour perceptions of a time. And it did feel like it suddenly kind of left a bit of a dent in some of the progress that people felt that that Spurs had been making.
Yeah, if they get to the final, I think they'd all be quite excited.
Yeah. Okay, we're talking about finals. Let's just go back to the Champions League, if we could, please, chaps. I think probably we've established who our top four will be this season. Prediction time. Who wins the Champions League this season?
I'll go Liverpool, because I think the African Cup of Nations could just affect their potential title challenge. And I also don't think they have the strength and depth of Chelsea or City. But I do think their top level is arguably higher than both, and that could come to bear in the Champions League.
Glenn?
Ooh, I'm torn. I think I'm going to go for City, simply because having come so close last year, I think they may end up seeking almost to prioritise the Champions League. It's the one thing they haven't made to get yet.
That's true. I'd probably side with Miggs on this one, and that might involve a bit of a history lesson. And there is a point to it, I promise. Liverpool won the European Cup in successive years, 77, 78. They won it twice more before that unforgettable night in Istanbul in 2005. And that was one of the occasions which essentially wove the rebranded Champions League into the fabric of the club. It inspires a powerful shared passion in players, managers and fans alike. Madrid's just another fantastic recent memory. I've got a hunch Liverpool might be eased out of a tight Premier League race, but Europe's different. St. Petersburg on May the 28th next year might be, just might be, the place to be. Do you share my optimism, Liverpool fans? Please let me know. In the meantime, thanks to Miguel and Glenn for their insight, and thank you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.